Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us on the line from Nashville, Tennessee, Ed Nipper. And Ed worked here in the Santa Cruz area for many years while he went to college and got his degree at Bethany. He, of course, had a program right here on KFER for many years. And then one day he came and said, I'm going to leave here and I'm going to sell what I have and I'm going to go over. I'm going to be a missionary in Kurdistan. And I was a little surprised to hear that, but, you know, in some ways I thought, what a wonderful, wonderful challenge. Well, Ed's been there. How long have you been over there now, Ed?
Well, I've been over there for a year, and I just got back, and excited about returning. And thank you for having me on your show, Dr. Stan.
Well, Ed really was brought back. He didn't want to come back, I don't think. But Bill Garraway, who with the Church of the King, heads the servant group that leads this missionary alliance that Ed is working for, and so they just thought it would be wise with the war coming and the uncertainties of perhaps a Turkish invasion of that area or an Iraqi invasion of the area. Anyway, for the time being, it's better off to be home here. And besides that, of course, there's a real need for more people to go over to work in the school there, and they have an opportunity to open many other classical schools there, where, of course, they have an opportunity to spread the gospel actively in Kurdistan. And probably there's no place in the entire Muslim world where the gospel is being spread as efficiently and as widely and as rapidly as in Kurdistan. What about that, Ed? Is that a fairly accurate statement?
Well, I think that's true. I don't know the statistics, but as far as being open and free to have a church, to have a classical Christian school in the Kurdish area, we call the no-fly zone, the protectorate state, that the Americans and British have been protecting for the last 11, 12 years, to have that opportunity to do that. I don't think, Dr. Stan, most people realize that there is a live and well and growing evangelical Christian church in northern Iraq.
And I think that's sort of exciting, because you're an integral part of that. Well, why don't you, first of all, tell us what it's like over there, what the people are like, the various factions there, and then, of course, what you and your wife are doing there.
Sure. Well, living over there is much different than living here in the United States. I live about an hour from the border of Iran. We work in a huge city, and most of the people there are what I would call being-oriented. In the States, you know, we tend to be doing-oriented, and they're much more into being, having tea, having fruit, conversation. You know, when you look at the Old Testament, you see a lot of eating and talking going on. Well, that's exactly the epitome of what goes on in northern Iraq. There's eating and talking and fellowshipping and getting to know one another. And one of our biggest struggles going over there, trying to work with the church and work with classical school that needs, is adjusting ourselves to this being culture. You know, we have a lot of books in America that talk about self-image and you know, who you are and all this type of stuff, but we don't practice that. We like to read them and feel good about ourselves, but it's hard to practice that. Well, over there, they don't have that type of books, but they practice being with each other and relying upon each other. So we had to learn a whole different way of living. They also don't have a lot of amenities over there like we do. They do have almost every Kurdish house has a satellite, and they have a TV. Because it's been a protectorate state and they've had some form of democracy the last 12 years, they have had some liberty to buy things that have come in from Turkey or have come in from Iran, and to purchase video equipment, things of that nature. And there's a lot of internet going on over there in northern Iraq, at least where I was at, in the cities, internet all the time going on. So they're starting to build up, you know, their commerce. They're starting to build up importing things that we have in the States. It's not quite like that. Before I got there, maybe you had 2 hours electricity a day. After I got there, we had about 22 hours electricity a day, and we had a wash machine that was from a Turkey, brand new wash machine, but no dryers because electricity is still pretty scarce and you go off amperage, so you have to be careful what you use.
All right. Well, now, what about the industry? How do the people there make a living, or is it mainly the oil that keeps them going?
Well, no. The oil doesn't keep them going. It may keep the people who are in high government keep them going, but as far as the ordinary person, no. You know, the Food for Oil program that the UN has set up, that keeps them going as far as their staples. They do get their rice and their oil and their tea, obviously, and a few other staples to survive, and that's pretty, once a month, that's what they get. And so they survive off of this. They have what they call free work there. Everybody has, not everybody, but a lot of people have work to do, but it's not so significant work. Maybe somebody is a carpenter and he's helping laying some bricks or something. They call that free work. Other people have shops, or what we call dukans in Kurdish, little shops where they sell, you know, knickknacks, or they sell meat, or they sell bread, or they, you know, and they try to make a living off of that. And the whole family is pretty much involved in that type of business.
Now, what about agriculture? Do they grow much of their food there?
They do grow some food there. They're not a whole lot. Some things are imported. One thing that I did like about living there was you did get fresh bread every day. There's no preservatives in it. You do get fresh fruit, seasonal fruit, fresh meat, and they'll cut it for you right there. Even kill the chicken right there, and it's definitely fresh. And when I was there, I lost 20 pounds when I lived in Kurdistan, northern Iraq. Here, I think, you know, we're all into this diet stuff, and I just really think a lot of it has to do with self-control. And if you don't go to the fast food restaurants, McDonald's and Burger King and Taco Bell, you won't gain that weight. And I remember going to the refrigerator on a couple nights, opening the refrigerator door and seeing nothing to eat pretty much, and saying, well, I guess I'll have another piece of bread. So I lost weight pretty quick.
Oh, now, of course, as far as the safety is concerned over there, you're an American, you're a Christian. Now, are there groups over there that don't like the Christians? What about the Al-Qaeda? What about the Islamic terrorist element? Is there an element there in northern Iraq?
Yes, there is, Dr. Stan. Most of the people there, you know, are not Al-Qaeda as far as the common person, and they're not Jindal Islam. They're very common people. They want to live like you and I. They want to have their own home. They want to raise their children. They want education for them. They're just common folk. Pretty ignorant of Islam, though. They practice Islam, but pretty ignorant. Most of them, you know, can't understand or read the Quran because the Quran is in classical Arabic. And none of them have an education, for the most part, to read classical Arabic. So this is why you have the mullah or the imam or those who are can read classical Arabic dictate to what the Quran says to the flock, so to speak. But there are dangers within the city and with outside the city. You have Jindal Islam. You do have Al-Qaeda. You do have fractionist groups that want to rise up and control or come in and take over any part of any city in northern Iraq. This poses a problem for the government. They try to keep it under control. Many Peshmerga, that's what they call Kurdish soldiers, Peshmerga, which means prepared to die, or mountain fighters, that's what they're known as, have given their lives to protect the people. It is dangerous. There is threats there. One of our teachers had a bomb placed under her car. There was one of our staff members almost had a rocket launcher launched into his house. Those are far in between, but you have to be careful. And kind of like I say, have a third eye, you know, kind of look around, make sure, look for strange things. There are certain rules that you have to follow when you're there, just for safety.
All right. Now, you say you're not too far away from the Iraqi border. Is there some sort of a ceasefire line between Iraq and Kurdistan? Because at one time, of course, Saddam controlled all of Kurdistan, all of this entire area. So certainly he can't bring his planes up there, but how do they keep the ground troops from Iraq from invading Kurdistan?
Well, as far as I was told, I used to travel in northern Iraq to the cities and in certain villages, or pass them by at least. Someone would say, well, you know, we can't take that road down to the left, which, you know, will take you to Mosul, which is controlled by Saddam, or will take you to Kirkuk, which is controlled by Saddam. But Mosul, by the way, is Nineveh, which we have in the Old Testament. And I was so sad in my heart, because I would love to go to Nineveh and visit these places. Remember, that's Mesopotamia. That's the Fertile Crescent. We don't call it Mesopotamia anymore, but that's the biblical name for it.
That's where Jonah went.
That's right. And Father Abraham lived in that. Father Abraham lived exactly where I live, and so I'm overwhelmed with that. The Garden of Eden is there. The Magi came from there. There's lots of history there. So there is, I've been told, there is a neutral zone between these places of the line of Iraq. I've never been there. I don't ever want to go to that neutral line zone. But that's pretty much how I think it works.
So Kurdistan has its own army, and they're able then to keep Saddam's army at bay. And since he can't bring in his helicopter gunships now and his planes to bomb, why he leaves the Kurds pretty well alone?
They do, but keep in mind, the Kurds' army is—they can't fight on flat ground. They're sitting ducks. They're not very good fighters on level ground. They're superb fighters when they're in the mountains. In fact, they've actually held off Saddam's army when they were in the mountains. But the minute Saddam flies airplanes or helicopters, it's all over for the Kurds. They don't have a standing army like we do. They have Peshmergas who are raised in certain organizational groups like the PUK or the PDK or the people of that nature, those political groups. They're fighters, they're mountain fighters, and they're willing to do their job for the most part.
All right, now you basically have two major political parties. What is one communist, the other a socialist, what's the PUK and what's the PDK?
Yeah, the PUK is the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, and that's run by Jalal Talabani. That's in the north. No-fly zone, obviously.
And now, what are they? Are they simply a nationalist organization? Are they a communist organization? How would you characterize them, or can you?
I'm not quite sure, Dr. Stan. I know that all of them claim to be Islam, but they differ in their political views with each other. I haven't read enough of my history to know exactly their origins, but I know that in that area in the late 1800s, there was a lot of internal fighting. And later on, after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, there were these countries, not countries, but there were these regions that were Nicenes. They were broken up, spread apart, and then after World War I, they were made into countries, some of these places. And so that you have the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which is the PUK, which is Jalal Talabani. He's supposedly the educated one. Then you have the PKK, that's the Kurdistan Workers' Party, and that's on the Turkish side. And you have the KDP, which is the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which is Musad Barzani. He's supposed to be the uneducated one. I've traveled in his area. I live on the PUK side, but I've traveled in the Barzani area, and it's very beautiful, very nice. Both sides are beautiful and nice. But those are the three main groups. The KDP and the PUK is in northern Iraq, and the PKK is in fighting for independence in Turkey.
All right, so basically you have, so Saddam wanted to take back Kurdistan. The Kurds don't want to be taken back, but they have three independent units there, and they not only fight Saddam and his men, they fight one another. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, that's very true, and that's very sad because, it's hard for them to unite and to get together. Dr. George Grant, who's an acquaintance friend of mine, He's doing lectures on Islam, and I've been attending them monthly. He said that, you know, one of the problems, I know you would appreciate this, Dr. Stan, he said one of the problems with American foreign policy is that we underestimated when we went in World War One, and he actually said that World War Two is an extension of World War One, that we underestimated the grudges and the slights and the fractions and the anger and the hatred that Middle Eastern people have towards one another throughout the centuries. And so when we go into these countries and try to bring unity to all these groups, we need to remember that they have, you know, centuries of anger and animosity and killing towards one another. And it's very difficult to get them together to agree upon hardly anything.
All right, fine. Well, of course, you're in a unique position there because you don't affiliate with any of these. You're just there ostensibly to have a classic school, but actually, of course, you're there to promote the kingdom of our Lord.
Exactly. I don't involve myself too thoroughly with the PUK. I've had meetings with government officials because that's our duty. That's our goal, is to help them and to do what we can in the city. But we do have a classical Christian school in the city. And here's a school that has almost 200 students, all Muslim, pretty much about 99.5, a couple Christian kids. And we're giving them an education from grade 1 to 12. Right now we're at grade 1 to 6. We give them an education that teaches them that, first of all, God is love. Remember, in Islam, there are 99 names for God, and there is no name for God that means love. And so we're telling them, look, God is love. God is with you. God cares about you. And giving them biblical principles. Remember, also in Islam, God is not with you. He is so transcendent, so other than you, that he can never be imminent with you or close with you. He cannot be your friend, like the Bible calls it. Jesus is our friend in some respect. And so, you know, when they grow up in the school and they hear these things, these biblical ethical principles of don't lie, which is a very hard thing for Middle Eastern people. Lying is a part of way of life. You know, be kind. Environmental things. I mean, they litter everywhere. They just throw stuff on the ground. They don't give it a second thought. And so to teach these kids, don't litter. This is God's creation. He wants you to keep it beautiful. We've had an example of a kid who parents were out on a picnic, and they were littering their stuff, and the kid went back and picked up the stuff and threw it in the garbage can. You know, these are small things, but these are things that are, through time, that are going to change by the grace and love of God.
And let me just mention for our listeners out there that certainly one reason that Ed was brought back, over and above the fact that there is tremendous danger and there may be a lot of violence, especially if the Turks move down into that region, is the fact that they need more people to go over and teach in the school. And if you're actually interested in learning more about this, why, you can call 831-476-4877. That's 831-476-4877. And Bill Garraway was with us this afternoon and was telling us really about the marked need that you have for more Christians to go over there and help with the education. And here you've got, a school with 200 children in it, and you have how many English-speaking teachers, or how many, Christians do you have there?
Right. Well, we have, at one time, we had five of us over there. My wife is a professional teacher, and we have one other professional teacher. I am not. I got my degree in biblical and theological studies, and I primarily work with the church and train the elders. And by the way, we do need to have some more people in Bible knowledge who would want to go and help train the leadership of the church. When we get back from a break, Dr. Stan, I'll tell you more.
And, of course, the thing is that they've got about 1,000 Christians. Now, this is in 10 years. Doesn't sound like very many, but, it's been very, very hard to get Christians in Muslim countries. And here you have probably one of the most rapidly growing Christian churches anywhere in the Muslim world, right there in Kurdistan. So this is a real challenge, and who knows how God can use this in the weeks and months that lie ahead. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our friend Ed Nipper talking about his mission and their efforts in Kurdistan. Well, Well, Ed is with us now, and so why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on there, you know, in the school, that your needs there as a, certainly as missionaries, and although you're ostensibly there in education, you're also there to teach the elders in the Curtis Church so that they and can develop their own ministers so that they can carry on preparing them to become leaders in their own country. And then, of course, it really is so interesting that certainly you're not supposed to proselytize in a Muslim country, and yet the officials there know what you're doing, and they certainly don't object to what you're doing, do they?
No, not at all. We have no problems with the government with that. Let me just make an appeal to those who are listening. You know, I never felt called, quote, called to do missions work or to do, or to be an instructor, in, especially not in, in Kurdistan, Northern Iraq. But when I heard the philosophy, when I heard how we want to reach this culture, not just plant churches or start medical centers or do orphanages and those things you need to do. You need to do those in every country. But we want to take it beyond that. We want to take it into the seven spheres of a society, the arts and the music, you know, the education, the family, the church, business, government. We want to take that gospel of Jesus Christ in unique ways into all those spheres and change that culture from within out. We do need teachers, Dr. Stan. We need teachers, school teachers, people who teach second grade, third, fourth grade, seventh, eighth grade, eighth grade, doesn't matter. Believe me, if you're available and you want to do that and ready to go, we have a semester, people can come for 4 months, 5 months, they come for a year, they come for 2 years, and work within the school. And it's hard work, let me tell you. It's not easy work. You work a lot of hours. You have to deal with the culture. Sometimes you don't have all the amenities. It's not easy. But it's definitely rewarding to see things and people change for the glory of God.
Well, I envy you, you know, and the opportunity that you're having there, and especially many of these children are actually the children of the governmental leaders, aren't they?
That's very true, and we're very blessed to have them there. when we first opened the school, 2001, we had something of over 250 applicants come and want to come to our school. We could only accept at that time, I think it was about 60 students. We had one government official came with his son and his two guards, and they had their Kalashnikovs, and they wanted to register their son. Well, you know, how can you say no to someone like that? You know?
Especially when there's two people with machine guns.
That's right. But I want to tell you, you know, we do have a website, and if you want more information on this, look it up. There's an application online. It's called csmeds.org. That's csmeds.org.
All right, and of course, CSMEDs, and that's like the Medes and the Persians, isn't that right?
That's right, and that's that we believe that the Kurds are the descendants of the Medes from Darius. They are from that region, and so we want to, you know, give tribute to them, and that's why we call it the Classical School of the Medes.
All right, MEDES.com,
.org.
.org, okay. And we'll be back here in just a moment with more of this discussion of what's going on in Kurdistan and a small group of Christians, in fact, really centered right here in the Santa Cruz area, are having such an impact in that region of the world. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our special guest this evening is Ed Nipper, who I've known for many, many years, and I'm so glad that he's back here. And right now we've got Joey calling in from Capitola. Hi, Joey. How are you doing?
Hey, good, great. I had a question about, you said people in the Middle East lie or tend to lie, and I've heard this mentioned before. I was wondering if you could explain, like, the cultural aspects of how that is and how it's different from our society and our culture.
Sure, no problem. I'll try to do that.
All right, thanks.
There's part of lying in the Middle East, at least let me just be more specific in where I'm from, in Kurdistan, is out of a need for survival and out of a need for trusting people. They don't trust people at face value. And so in order for them to survive, in order for them to have feelings of safety, they kind of play a colloquial game, and they hide their cards, so to speak, and maybe they don't tell the truth or the whole truth about a particular person or a particular location, just because there had been a lot of ratting going on in that culture for many, many years. And so those are at least two aspects of why we have found and discovered that people do lie to you. Now, they won't come out and boldly lie to your face, because then you would detect that, and they're not that stupid, but they'll do it in a way that's undermining, and it's slighting, so to speak. And that's basically the two reasons why. And human nature. Fallen human nature.
All right, fine. And so it's really, as you say, a matter of survival. And then, of course, they don't have the Christian ethic that you're not supposed to, a Christian is not supposed to lie. But is there any objection to lying in the Muslim religion?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I've heard people say, no, not so. But I don't want to misrepresent Islam on that. I don't know. I do know, well, this is one thing that I am discouraged about with America, or at least American people, is that I know we're a Christian nation, supposedly. I know we've lost a lot of things that are called Christian in our culture. But we have a tendency to we're supposed to forgive, but we have a tendency to drag this thing out, to trust people beyond what they're supposed to be capable of being trusted about. And we want to give chances over and over and over and over and over again, and yet people, especially in Iraq, we're talking about Saddam, they love that stuff. They eat it up. They can play off of that and extend things ad infinitum, ad nauseum, by this type of, quote, charity that we do in the United States. You know, over there, you have one chance for forgiveness. That's it. If you do something to somebody else a second time and you harm them in a physical or moral or spiritual type of way, they cut you off. And you're cut off for many, many years. I mean, we have a problem here just with Kurds in Nashville. Two people are having a difficult time, and they won't talk to each other. You know, one is speculating that someone did something else, and the other is speculating somebody that he did something else, and they won't even get together and see each other.
Now, of course, I think for our listeners out there who don't understand what Kurdistan has to do with Nashville, the largest concentration of Kurds, or one of the largest concentration of Kurds anywhere in the world outside of Kurdistan, is in Nashville, isn't it?
That's right. This is the largest concentration of Kurds outside of, inside the United States. Over 7,000 Kurds live here.
And now, why did they go to, of all places, Nashville? I mean, did they like the singing there?
Yeah, they love it. you know as well as I know that after the Gulf War, they were brought here by the United States. And a lot of them came off the planes, and our government gave them freedom and protection to live here. I don't know specifically, maybe you know, specifically why Nashville, but this is where they are located at. And we have a tremendous, in fact, we're working hard all the time to reach the Kurdish people here in Nashville. And after Nashville, San Diego. You know there are 35 million Kurds, Dr. Stan, and the largest people group without their own nation or country. And Kurdistan makes, you have northeast Syria, and you have east Turkey, and you have Iran, west and south, north Iran, and a little bit into Iraq, and that makes up Kurdistan.
All right, fine. Of course, this is a... Tragically, it's one of those situations where the Westerners and their wisdom went into that area after the break of the Ottoman Empire, after the First World War, and just chopped up in little pieces and gave a little bit to various people that they like, and they created all these countries that have no basis at all with race, culture, or anything else. And of course, we are now inheriting, and these people have had to live with the tragic interference of Great Britain and France in partitioning that part of the world, and creating also nothing but problems for the people that haunt them to this very day. We'll be back here in just a few minutes with our special guest, Ed Nipper, and we'll be talking about Kurdistan. Welcome your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, Dr. Stan here, and our guest this evening is Ed Nipper, and we're talking about what's going on in Kurdistan, and an entirely different culture. In fact, I understand, Ed, that you actually travel with a couple of guards, and you actually many times will carry a sidearm yourself there?
Yes, that's true. We have a number of guards that guard our house. You know, every Kurdish house has some type of wall and gate with it, and we do have guards. I do carry a sidearm, and perhaps that's some Christians out there listening are thinking, wow, you know, an instructor, a missionary carrying a sidearm, that's new. Maybe so, but I didn't want to take any chances going to a country where I couldn't protect my family. I'm not a pacifist. I'm not a person who desires violence, but I'm also one who has taken martial arts in the past for several years and want to protect my family if something happens. I'm not under the persuasion that some Christians are that if, you know, if someone comes in and robs your house, you just let them rob your house and do nothing about it. No, I'm going to go get that guy, and I'm going to kill him. Get out of my house. And that's how I feel when I go to Kurdistan. If someone comes in my house to kill me, I'm going to try to kill them. So I know that sounds shocking, but that's how I believe. That's what I believe.
All right, fine. Well, of course, it's your obligation to look after your family, and you have a child, and you have a wife there. And, of course, this is a very, very potentially violent area, and I'm sure many of the other people there feel the same way. Is most of the population there armed?
Well, there's a lot of guns there. I don't know about most of the population, but it's normal to see people, well, guards at least, soldiers walking around with Kalashnikovs. It's a normal, everyday occurrence. I've seen some men with sidearms shown. No, I don't show my sidearm. I hide my sidearm. So there are guns there. We've had, you know, we've had our problems. We've had a brother in the past that worked for a bookstore, got killed. We just had another brother up in Zaho that got killed.
Now these are, of course, Christian Muslims?
Yes, I'm not quite sure about the former. This was some time ago, but the former one. But there are some assassinations that do happen because of the Christian faith, and because of, you know, some people don't like that, and they're going to do something about it.
All right, now about how many Christians are there in your part of Kurdistan? Now, I'm talking about evangelical Christians. I understand that there's the old Chaldean church and the Assyrian church of that go back, you know, almost to the time of Christ, but, you know, at least of the evangelical Christians that you represent.
Yes, you're right. There are the Chaldeans, and I did look up who the Chaldeans were if you wanted to know. But
well, you can tell us. I'd like to know.
Well, the Chaldeans was the church in the east, in ancient Chaldea. They are not the historical Chaldeans that go far, far, far back, but they are the Chaldeans talk about in Al-Qaedian. But these are the Chaldeans that the Catholic Church incorporated. They didn't want to call them Nestorians, so they changed the name to Chaldeans. And this was about the 17th century. Then there's the Assyrians, and the Assyrians came about by the Anglican missionaries in, I think, 1842, that gave them this name, those that were remaining in the Church of the East that did not become Roman Catholic. So we have this modern Assyrians.
Now, this is what, Eastern Orthodox, then?
Yes.
Okay.
Now you come to the Kurds, who are not, you know, most of them are not Assyrian or Chaldean, but Muslim. You come to the Kurds now, who are converting to evangelical Protestantism. There has been missions in Kurdistan, mostly Presbyterian missions. There is a Presbyterian church in Baghdad, but it's, you know, it's under governmental authority and thumbed by the government. They're not allowed to proselytize. So, you know, not much light there. But there is light in northern Iraq where the gospel can be preached. Not that we don't have problems. Not that sometimes you have to be careful, you have to be wise. Sometimes the government in one particular city, you know, tries to give you a little bit of hassle. But you work with it, and you just keep going, and you keep doing the right thing.
All right, fine. And so, but about how many evangelical Christians are there at the present time?
Yeah, I would say a safe number would be about 700 to 1,000. I would say about 700. You know, there's no throw up to church type of thing and sit down and we'll count heads. It doesn't work that way in that culture. We're building actually a church in one of the cities, and we're trying to get that done. But most of it is met in one person's house or in a bunch of different houses, or people come for discipleship to a particular house throughout the day or throughout the week.
And now you are actually then training the potential ministers, the elders of the church, so that they'll be able to, of course, carry on and understand the faith sufficiently to transmit the ideas to their parishioners?
That's true. Each city has a number of elders, and you know, I can't be in three cities at one time, but in the city that I was in, I was able to not only disciple them, but disciple some of the teachers and some of their wives. And the funny thing is when I first got there, I laid out all these different types of books that I brought with me. I said, okay, you can pick one. Whatever you want to do, we'll study it. Now, keep in mind that it's in English, so I have to have it translated. I have a written translator, and I also have a verbal translator. There's a lot of work that goes into this. So you know what they picked? They picked the covenants. I didn't tell them to do it at all. They just picked it. I thought, well, that's strange. Why would they pick that? Well, you know, they love the Old Testament. They love the Old Testament, and they love the book of Genesis, and they love the New Testament, too. But that's their history in the Old Testament. It's kind of the opposite in the States. You know, we don't really like the Old Testament, but we love the New Testament. Well, it's not that way there. So we went through covenants. We went through three or four major covenants in the Old Testament. We talked a lot. I gave them tests. We shared a lot, and they grew a lot. We also, Joe and I, did a marriage class. We did a book by Doug Wilson called Reforming Marriage. And we had five or six married couples there, ranging from anywhere from 10 years of marriage to 20 years of marriage. And one new believer came up to me and said, he said, you got to put this stuff on the radio, because we have a radio program there as well, and a bookstore, Christian bookstore. And I started to chuckle a little bit. And after 20 years of marriage, he came to Joe and I and his wife. He said, you know, he said, we have learned so much in the 7 months that it has changed the way we view each other in our marriage.
Well, that's quite a tribute to you. And because how long have you been married?
11 years.
Oh, well, of course. Well, I didn't realize you'd been married that long. Well, then, you're a really old-timer. So anyway, of course, this is an exciting thing to think of here, this country, and here there's a small group of missionaries, and they're having such a profound impact. And, of course, it's not simply 700 to 1,000 people, but each one of those people can begin reaching others. And what a unique opportunity in the Muslim world to have an opportunity to profess your faith. I mean, you couldn't do this in Saudi Arabia. You couldn't do this in any of the in Pakistan today, or even in India today, why there's tremendous anti-Christian bias. But here in Kurdistan, simply because of the people, appreciate what we have done there, at least as far as at the present time, guarding them with our plane flight so Saddam can't come in and slaughter more as he has in the past. And for our listeners who are out there in the listening audience, I think you should know that, you know, there were about 5,000 Kurds who were killed by poison gas by Saddam. And so many of the Saddam apologists will try to tell you that, oh, well, that was really done by the Iranians. But nobody in Kurdistan really believes that, do they?
No, you're correct. They don't believe that.
Only people who believe that would be the Americans, who are subject to all the pro-Saddam propaganda we get here.
Yeah, that's probably so. There's a good website. There's a good Kurdish website. I don't know actually who puts it out, but it's called krg.org, and you can go and look at some pictures of Halabja and different things that are going on in Kurdistan up to date right now.
Now, Halabja was where the actual attack, the gas attack.
That's right. In fact, 3 days ago, they just celebrated 1988 when that happened, March 15th. They took a 5-minute silence, and I wouldn't say celebrated, but you know, remembered.
Right.
The tragedy. 5,000 Kurds died. 7,000 were injured and put up and had physical problems. You know, Saddam is responsible for 1.5 million deaths in Iraq. That's a lot. That's a lot of people killed. And I, one thing, you know, when we talk about missions, doing missions to Muslims is not easy. It's very difficult, and it takes a lot of work to do it. I don't want people to think that, you know, that you have to wait for things to be legal in these countries, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Pakistan, to go in and preach the gospel. Some people think that, you know, you shouldn't go in those countries, they're illegal, they don't want the gospel. You know, like in Afghanistan, they said, look, you can come here, but as long as you don't proselytize, as long as you don't talk about Jesus, you just sign this paper. Fine, you're Christians, no problem. Sign this paper, don't proselytize, and you can live here. That happened in Afghanistan. And Christians were signing papers.
Yeah, but unfortunately, that, you know, they were going to kill two or three of those women, you know, unfortunately they were rescued. But, I mean, they had been condemned to death. I mean, the crime was they were accused of trying to spread the gospel.
That's right. And you know, unfortunately, sometimes that happens. You have to pay the price for the gospel. I know we're not used to that in the States. We're not used to hearing that. But believers around the world who live in these countries, who lived in these closed, quote, closed countries, oftentimes do pay the price for preaching the gospel. But, you know, the gospel doesn't say, well, wait till the countries open up and then go preach. No, Paul never did that. You go anyways. You find a way to get in, and you get in and you minister to the gospel. And that's what I think is unique about what we're doing, is we have an opportunity. Here's this window of opportunity that God has given us. Let's step through. Let's send missionaries. You know, you can't win a war by sending two soldiers. You can't do it. You got to send a platoon. You got to get people raised up, go over there, and get involved, get their feet dirty and their hands dirty, and start working. And stop going to the easy places. I'm sorry, but, you know, we need to start thinking about how can we reach these Muslims that make up over 1 billion people in faith and reach them with the gospel.
Well, it sounds like you're doing everything that you possibly can, and you're having an impact. And fortunately, with this, what is the name of the ministry you're with?
I'm with Servant Group International.
Servant Group International, and they really focus there on this Kurdistan, and they're really centered right here in the Monterey Bay area. And this is at least where Bill Garraway, who leads this group at the present time, is. And they're having an impact. Missionary impact on one part of the world. Now, apparently there is one of the cities, they have a small medical clinic, although they don't have a lot of, they don't have any doctors there. They have a hard time getting doctors to go in. And Bill was saying this afternoon that all the difficulty that had, you know, the doctors, a whole flock of them were ready to go, but they got held up, certainly immigration. They just weren't allowed in the country. What was that all about?
Yeah, I think, I don't know the whole story behind that, but that's true. They did get held up in the country. That was before I actually came in. Unfortunately, they wasted all their time, and only a few got in able to do the work. There is a need, even for not only for teachers and for Bible teachers to come, but there's a need for nurses. There's a need for those in the medical group to come and train. Even, I mean, we bring in medical books, and you know, we take those medical books, those medical journals, up-to-date medical journals, and we put them in the Christian bookstores that we have here. And you think, why do you put medical journals in a Christian bookstore? That's kind of weird. But, you know, you're trying to reach the whole culture there to some degree. So these physicians who know that they're going to get good American, European medical journals go into the Christian bookstore, still justified going in, you know, and they pick up a journal, and they pick up another book, and they leave.
Well, I think it's great. Any way that you can spread the gospel, because, you know, you never know when you put a seed in the ground whether it's going to become rooted and create fruit, reproduce itself. But if you don't put the seed in the ground, why, nothing's going to happen.
That's
Tell
right.
us a little bit about the marshes in Iraq. Is this a big factor?
Well, the marshes, unfortunately, environmentally, Saddam has destroyed the marshes. The marshes used to be full and in bloom and filled with fish and filled with flowers and filled with all different types of species that lived in the marshes in Iraq. The marshes really start below Basra, which is near Kuwait, and run all the way up from the Euphrates River and Tigris River and go almost halfway, three-quarters of Iraq in the center and into the east. It's hard to describe it if you don't know the picture of Iraq in your mind.
Well, that wasn't most of that. A lot of that area was where the Shia Muslims are. And I think that Saddam is a Sunni, and the Shia are really almost the majority of the people, and they live in the south, and Saddam doesn't like them, and they don't like him. And didn't a lot of them live in the marshes?
That's very true. They call them marsh Arabs. A lot of them lived there. They had made their homes in the marshes, lived off the land in the marshes. And, you know, after the uprising, after the war and during the uprising, Saddam crushed the Shiites, and they all, you know, escaped to the marshes. And in order for him to kill them, he had to clear the marshes. And so you have this great land, you know, filled with all different types of species of fish and birds and flowers, that almost about 90% of it has been destroyed.
Where are the environmentalists when we need them?
Yeah.
Where is the outcry from, the Earth First and from the Sierra Club?
You know, I don't know. You know, I don't know if you listened to Rush Limbaugh today, but I heard him on the radio talking about, you know, he was assuming that there's, the human shields that were in Iraq.
Right.
You know, they're guarding the oil refineries, you know. And here they are, you know, liberals, environmental wackos, and all these type of people, and here, you know, they're guarding an oil refinery in New York, in Iraq, and yeah, he found that so oxymoronic that, you know, they cry out in America about anything about oil, but then they go and guard an oil refinery in Iraq.
Well, I think, you know, they were initially there. They wanted to be put into the hospitals. They wanted to be put into the electricity, the water purification area, so that they wouldn't be bombed. But my understanding is most of the human shields have actually left. The leaders of this said that they were being used for political purposes, and they were being probably put into areas like the oil refineries. This wasn't where they wanted to be. And, you know, we can make criticize these people, but these people, a lot of them are willing to risk their lives for what they believe in. In other words, they think that this war is wrong. Whether they are right or whether they're wrong, at least they cared enough to risk their lives to do something. I wonder how many Americans whether they feel strongly enough about anything that they're willing to give their life. And yet, of course, if you're not willing to give your life for something, then your life really isn't worthwhile. And I will never forget what Whitaker Chambers said about Alger Hiss when somebody said, oh, you probably hate Alger Hiss, don't you? Whitaker Chambers had testified against Alger Hiss. And Whitaker Chambers said, how could I ever hate a man who agreed with me that that life is not worth living, for which a man is willing to give it up at any moment? If you don't have something you're willing to die for, you don't have anything ready to live for. And whether you agree with them or not, and certainly I think that it was a stupid thing to go over there and support Saddam's government. At least they cared.
Yeah, I think you got to have some type of agenda or something to live for or die for. Unfortunately, I think they were put in a place where is typical of Saddam. He's not going to put them in hospitals and orphanages. He doesn't care about that. He wants to put them in places where he does care about, and that's the oil refineries.
Sure.
And the military camps or where stockpiled weapons are. That's where he can use them.
Well, I hope most of them have had the good sense to get out of there, because I think it's going to be a terrible, terrible situation, and they're not going to accomplish anything at all, unfortunately.
No, and I think you're right on that. Do you mind if I give my website one more time?
Go ahead and give it twice.
Yeah. Well, okay. This is a new website, and so those who are interested in being teachers in any way, shape, or form, look up csmeds.org. That's csmeds.org, and that'll give you more information on who we are, what we're doing, and a little preliminary application there for you.
All right, fine. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our Locally, it's 464-8295, and of course, it'll be over here until the peace is restored over there, and then you and your wife are planning on going back, aren't you?
Yeah, we're planning on going back. You know, once things calm down a little bit, we don't know what the government situation is going to look like. We really want to get back there to, you know, keep the school open and keep the school running smoothly, and I want to get back to fellowshipping with the church and training the elders and raising up leaders and things of that nature.
I understand your wife wasn't very anxious to leave.
No, it was very harder. It was much more harder for my wife than it was for me. I, you know, as a man, you get that instinct of I have to protect my family type of thing. And it was very hard even for my daughter to want to leave. She said no, you know, this was her home, and she wanted to stay. And so it was a difficult, agonizing time to go through and decide to leave. One of the elders came to us and said, you know, it's better if you do go because you put not only your life in danger because you are American, number one. You know, if I was something else, it wouldn't be too bad. And also you put our lives in danger as elders because, you know, we'd have to take you everywhere. We feel responsible for you, and we would have to. You don't know the language very well. You don't know the culture like they do. And so we'd get ourselves in situations where we could probably wind up getting everybody hurt.
And now, Chris, I think that the one of the major reasons I know that Bill Garraway was concerned was because of the Al-Qaeda influence over there and this radical Islamic influence. And, you know, if things did get chaotic, why, of course, the one thing they would want to do would be to strike out at Americans.
Right, right. And everybody made us aware of that.
How powerful is Al-Qaeda over there?
Well, I don't know specifically how powerful they are, but I know that they have caused a lot of problems for the government. And in one sense, I don't know all the details, but I remember they would have meetings at a particular hotel that I used to go and have Indian restaurant food at, and they would have meetings. I wouldn't necessarily know if they were Al-Qaeda. They don't have a sign on them or anything like that, but they were definitely Islamic, and they're definitely there to plan or to talk or to discuss about something going on. I don't know, but you can tell by their dress that they were definitely from the villages and from surrounding areas, and I always wondered about that.
Well, now, of course, my understanding is that they have beards. That's one of the things that's
right.
Required of them, and they wear the turbans. Is that different than the dress of the average person there?
Yeah, you can definitely tell a fundamentalist there. That's true. They do have beards. In fact, my guards say there goes a fundamentalist right there. And, you know, they would hate it. A lot of the Kurds, they just hate Islam. They hate it.
But yet they themselves are Muslim, but they separate the Muslim religion from Islam, because Islam is really more or less associated with Wahhabism and this whole radical jihad, a form of Muslim faith. Is that it?
Well, I don't know what... my persuasion is not that they hate the whole aspect of Islam, and they hate the ones who actually carry out these Islamic fundamentalist acts. They don't like Islam at all. They don't like. I mean, they're Muslim because they have to be Muslim because the government on their green card says you have to be Muslim.
Okay, so they're Muslims, but they're not Islamists. Would that be a fair statement?
I think if you're saying Islam as far as fundamentalism, as far as disastrous deeds of killing people, in one aspect, that is a fundamentalist type of view of Islam. Muslim is a person who practices Islam, and there are a lot of peaceful Muslims in the world. You know, they don't have any violent bones in their bodies to do anything of that nature. But the religion of Islam, if they studied the Quran and they've come to know Islam in essence, is not that peaceful way of life. And so the people who are not familiar with Islam, they dichotomize, and those who do know Islam, like Osama bin Laden, they practice the essence of Islam.
Which, of course, if you go back to the Quran, it has a great deal of violence in it, and just as Muhammad conquered by the sword, and certainly justified pillage and all sorts of killing people who didn't want to convert to their form of religion. So the modern-day Islamist will kill other Muslims simply because they don't believe the way they do.
Yeah, that's exactly true. You know, it's I know we focus a lot of that in our churches, and we focus a lot on that, and but let me point out one thing about Islam. Islam, remember, is not a redemptive religion. It's a religion of legalism or works salvation. It's not a redemptive religion. The basic tenet of Islam is man is born good. Man is not sinful. Man needs to follow the five pillars of Islam. Now here comes Christianity saying, no, man is sinful. Man is born with original sin. He desperately needs a savior. Islam, there is no savior. I don't know, you know, there have been some books coming out, Dr. Stan, that have been making comparisons with Islam, saying they're basically the same, and I just don't see that.
Of course it's not, and anybody who tells you that the Islam means peace is simply not lying, is simply lying to you. Islam means surrender, and surrender to this this whole structured religion.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, many Muslim people, they practice Islam, they go and pray, but they're praying out of fear. They're not praying out of love and devotion for a God who really cares about them and who sees them and wants to redeem them and bring them into heaven with them. Islam really is a male-dominated religion. You know, no woman can go to the mosque, only men. In heaven, you know, only men have 14 virgins and can do what they want with them. And it's a real male-dominated culture. You can see it. There's no equality for women in Islam. I know in America it looks different, but believe me, American Islam and Christianity, Middle Eastern Islam is two different worlds. Two different worlds.
I'm sure it is. Well, we're just about out of time, Ed. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I just want to encourage my brothers and sisters out there who are listening to keep up the faith, fight the good faith, to share your faith with a Muslim person. Just, you know, open up, befriend them, tell them that, you know, God loves them, Jesus cares about them, and wants to see them come to him. And yeah, you're going to get people who are going to get mad at you and call you all types of names, but you know, that's part of the gospel. So keep up the good work.
All right, well, God bless you, Ed, and we'll look forward to having you here as a guest when you get out here and into the West Coast.
God bless you too, Dr. Stan, and thank you for your work. May God blessings be upon you and your family.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Ed Nipper, and I certainly hope you enjoyed it. We've known Ed personally, and he's worked here with us, and now he's off doing God's work halfway around the world. How exciting it is, though, to know that people are willing to give up everything, all the material security that they think that they have here. But, of course, our only real security is in eternity, and they're willing to give up, of course, everything so that they can go off and preach God's word in other countries. And Ed certainly is exemplary. And if any of you are interested in perhaps even thinking going for a few weeks or a few months, why, it would be an exciting experience. And you can always call 831-476-4877. And so we certainly hope that many of you will give serious consideration to that. And this is the time when I have to remind our listeners in the Great Northwest that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're dependent upon you who listen to us for your help. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, our number 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. We ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders, to pray for our men going into battle. Pray for the civilians over there. Pray for the Iraqis, because most of them don't want to fight. And finally, please remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so we'll be back in just a few moments, tomorrow at the same time. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests. And right now we have with us on the line Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Foundation. Hi, Brad. How are you doing?
Oh, great to be on the program. Doing great.
Tell us what's going on in the legal field. Now, for those of you who don't know who Brad is, he is with the Pacific Justice Foundation. He was at the Rutherford Institute before, and when they pulled their office out of California, he had a choice of going back east or staying on his own and setting up his own legal team here, which he's done, and he's on the front lines of this battle. Of course, trying to get people to understand, that there really is real problems as far as Christianity being under attack today. And he's there to help people and schools and institutions that are coming under this attack. So tell us what's going on today.
Well, Dr. Stanley, as you know, we've seen a lot of challenges to churches on the West Coast, and particularly here in California, who want to build or expand, and they're told they're not allowed to. Well, we have we had a case specifically down in Glendora involving a church called Foothills Community Church, where they were told that they could not expand to have a daycare center or a preschool program. There were wonderful parts of their ministry, but they were told they couldn't do it, they couldn't expand, and it looked like the local government was very resolute on it. We had one of our affiliate attorneys, Richard Kateman, intervened on behalf of the church, did a fantastic job representing the church, and to make a long story short, I'm pleased to announce that the city of Glendora has gone a 180 degrees and has completely approved of that church being able to build and grow and expand in their community, and it's a wonderful victory for the people and parents of that community.
Well, I think what was it that Everett Dirksen said, politicians never see the light until they feel the heat, and I'm sure you applied a lot of heat to them.
we definitely do, and with the new recent Ninth Circuit decision declaring that city councilmen and planning commissioners can be personally liable for wrongfully denying a religious institution like a church the ability to build or expand, that's incredible firepower, and we're using it at the Pacific Justice Institute. I can assure you that.
Well, I'm so glad that you are, and I sometimes hate to play legal games, but on the other hand, I'm just glad that you have that trump card to play. All right, is there anything else you'd like to tell us?
That's about it. And if people would like to keep up with our cases, we're doing lots of exciting cases coming down. Feel free to take a look at our webpage, and you can sign up there to get our press releases. And if you'd like me to come speak to your church, I'm doing quite a bit of that recently, and I do that also without charge. And so just stay contact us, and we'd love to help.
All right, why don't you get your website out there for people and your telephone number if you'd like.
You bet. Our telephone number is 916-857-6900, 916-857-6900. Our website is pacificjustice.org, pacificjustice.org. And if you're interested in my speaking engagements and things that are coming up, we have those also listed on our webpage as well. I think I'm going to be speaking tomorrow morning for the Republican Women's Group down in Los Gatos.
Okay, fine. Well, best to your wife, and we'll be looking forward to seeing you or talking to you next week. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thank you, Dr. Smith.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, fine. And, of course, now we have a young lady named Sue Schuer, and we're going to be talking about vaccines. And so our producer is going to get her on the line here. And, of course, there's a lot to think about vaccines. There's about 1.5 million people in America today who have a severe allergy to peanut and peanut oil. Any peanut product can actually create a life-threatening response on them. And more people are becoming allergic, and more diseases are cropping up within our vaccinated community. Of course, the people who make the vaccines say that there's nothing to that, there's nothing to worry about, you can trust us. Why, our vaccines are perfectly safe. Well, of course, we're going to have to change this vaccine and take that one off the market and alter this one. And the government is telling us that the smallpox vaccine is absolutely safe. There's nothing to worry about, but they're going to put out $20 million to develop a safer vaccine. Well, if this one is safe, why are they putting out $20 million to develop a safer vaccine? And I'd like to suggest they're lying to you. They have an agenda. They believe that they're helping us. And yet with autism up some 600%. And so often I've heard that story from parents. My child was fine until they got their vaccine. And the next day they begin to regress. And with the devastating effect of autism and the fact that if there's nothing to worry about from vaccines, why is it that the government has passed laws pressured by the vaccine manufacturers that say you can't sue vaccine manufacturers for anything they do that's wrong? And I was talking with a gentleman just the other day who told me that he had actually taken a plane trip and the man sitting next to him worked for a vaccine manufacturer. And he was talking about, you know, how about they're doing some extensive analyses to see if, you know, maybe some of these vaccines you're using are harmful. And the fellow said, we're not going to do that sort of thing. Well, why not? Well, what would we do if we found that they were harmful? Well, what you would do is not put them on the market and harm people. But you see, they, of course, have a special category. If you harm somebody, you're liable. If you make a vaccine that harms a million people, why, nothing can be done to you. And there's something wrong with the picture. Well, Sue, how did you get interested in the vaccine subject?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I was brought into the issue unwillingly. My son, 25 years ago, my six-year-old infant son had a severe reaction to a DPT shot, and he received a DPT and an oral polio on the same day on a well baby visit, and so it was kind of a surprise attack.
Was this his first DPT shot or second?
Yes, his first doctor's visit.
Now, was he how old? What, he was how old at the time?
6 weeks old.
6 weeks old. And why we're vaccinating the children, you know, at such an early age, it's just ridiculous. I mean, we never used to vaccinate them that young. But now it seems like they're afraid that if we don't get them immediately, why, the parents might have some second thoughts. And so actually, they're actually vaccinating children in the nursery before they, first thing when they're born. Why, they want to give them the hepatitis B. Why? Because it isn't necessary. Because it's one of the most toxic vaccines we have, with more reactions than anything else. It's not a factor in the United States. It is a factor in other countries. And, of course, they need the money if they're going to give it to the people in China and in Vietnam and in Africa, where these things really are a problem. So they give it here at expensive rates. And, of course, now this money then is used to subsidize giving it all throughout the world. But there's no reason to give it here. In fact, there are far more complications with hepatitis B vaccine in children up to age 14 than there are cases of hepatitis B in the United States in children up to age 14. But, of course, they just never tell you that. Oh, we've got to do this because we're doctors and we know what's best for you. And I'm afraid that, I hate to say this, and it really has nothing to do with doctors. It has to do with the CDC. It has to do with money. It has to do with a social experiment. Maybe we can do away with this disease. Maybe we can. Let's just find out what we can do. So tell us what happened, Sue, and what happened to your child.
Well, he became fussy. He wanted to be held all the time. He didn't actually run a temperature. He was kind of cold and clammy, and he, you know, his face would turn white as a sheet. And he was in, you know, he just was in more and more distress. His voice got real high. His crying got very high-pitched.
Well, that's very, very characteristic of swelling of the brain, incidentally.
Yes. Yes.
You know that now, but you didn't at the time.
I didn't at the time, but I was calling my doctor every day, and I was pretty frantic, and I was telling him, you know, what was going on. I was describing it, and he was saying, well, does he have a fever? And I said, no, actually. So he said, well, as long as he doesn't have a fever, I'm not really concerned. And so I never got any response from him. On the third day, I had a particularly bad night with him, and I just called the doctor's office at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they patched me through to him, and I said, I'm taking him to the hospital. I don't care if you're there or not. I'm going to the hospital. And of course, he had me come right in then, and he was in the hospital for 8 days, and he had pneumonia, which they, you know, they couldn't figure out where it came from, and he was also having seizures. It took them 8 days to get him back to regular room air. He was on oxygen all that time.
Because the seizures are related to the swelling of the brain and the brain damage, which is so characteristic of DPT shots.
Yes. Yeah, I know. It took me, it actually took me 9 years to get information on it, and I found Barbara Lowe Fisher's book, DPT, A Shot in the Dark, in the library. And
if our listeners haven't read that book, it's an excellent, excellent book. It really is. It's really the first book on this subject, and pointing out that they lied, and they lied, and they lied, and they said there's nothing wrong with this vaccine, it's absolutely safe. They had a good vaccine, a much safer vaccine in Japan, and they refused to use it here, and they lied, and they lied, and then finally they said, oh yes, so we're going to change it now because we have a better vaccine, what, 20 years later?
Yeah, it took a long time, and it took NVIC constant lobbying and other groups lobbying to get that Japanese vaccine over here.
And of course, the thing is that this was almost like a toxoid. The other vaccine was made from the whole bacteria, and you got all sorts of reactions to it. And of course, the trouble with pertussis is it's the toxin that can create the damage, and you do not get the allergic reaction so much to the toxins as you do to the whole bacteria. And so this was ready to neutralize the toxin, which creates problems with children. Now, what happened to your child?
Well, he, you know, he was, you know, he didn't, well, first of all, when I took him home from the hospital, he couldn't, he lost every reflex he had, except a very weak suckling reflex, but he was allergic to, I had been nursing him, but, you know, that stopped in the hospital, and they weren't very encouraging, you know, to get me started on that again. And of course, it was difficult because he was very weak. So every formula I tried him on, he was throwing it up, and he was doing this projectile vomiting, you know, practically throwing up across the room. And here, this weak little baby who, you know, who couldn't even move hardly, was able to throw up, you know, 6 or 7 feet. So I was very frightened. I'd never seen a baby this sick in my life, and although he was my first child, I was the oldest of 5 children, so I'd taken care of 4 other babies and lots of cousins, and I'd never seen anything like this. And I finally got him on goat's milk, and you know, the first year he had all sorts of he had kind of a blotchy skin. His skin would get blotchy and orange every once in a while, and I now believe that was some kind of blood disorder. I'd run him to the doctor, and of course, by the time we got there, he'd be fine. And they'd, you know, tell me I needed a psychiatrist because there was nothing wrong with him. He was at the top of the charts, you know, right after he was born, as far as, you know, the percentiles that they
that the doctors measure, and he fell from the 95th percentile to the 5th percentile in head circumference, in weight, and in some other parameters. But basically, he had developmental delays through his childhood, and he started school in a special ed program, and he was in a contained special ed classroom his whole school life, and he's 25 years old now. His IQ was about 70 to 72. But he's a very good person. He's a nice young man. He's married, and he holds down a job, a regular job.
Well, there's always the question of what if we had not done that? What if we had not gotten those shots? And the question, as you've been looking into it further and further, you suddenly came to the realization that they've been lying, and that the fact is that the doctors, a lot of them, really don't know about these things, and they're told there's absolutely nothing to worry about. There are no reactions to these vaccines when the vaccine manufacturers know there are, and that's why they had the legislation passed. They couldn't be sued.
Yeah, I heard on the radio, I brought him home from the hospital in February, and I heard on the radio the next month that 17 infants had died in Illinois from the DPT shot.
Well, that was probably a bad batch. And as you've looked into this, aren't there certain batches that are much more toxic than others?
Yes, I think there are hot batches because they don't have very good controls on the manufacturing. They're mass producing this product, but they violate every aspect of our product liability laws. They don't test every vial, of course. They make up a big batch, and then they don't look under a microscope and count the number of microorganisms in each vial. They just kind of, in some cases, they just eyeball it for opacity. So it's very sloppy, and it's this kind of thing I don't think should even be mass-produced.
And, of course, the other thing is, were they putting thimerosal in the DPT at that time, the mercury compound?
Yes.
Of course, they know that there's not. I think the 1,500 studies showing that it's toxic. They have one study that was done by the manufacturer that says it's not toxic, which, of course, they had to say that, or the people who did it wouldn't have gotten paid. And, of course, based upon one study, despite the 1,500 other studies that said it was toxic and damaging, the way they've allowed it to be used until recently, when, of course, they finally, that there was just so much evidence out there, and they were talking about lawsuits, and so eventually then the class action suits, and then so eventually they at least, they've said, well, we'll take the mercury out of there. But how many children's brains have we destroyed with our vaccines? And if we couldn't trust them in the past, why should we think we would trust them in the future? It's like you use the analogy of Saddam Hussein. We couldn't trust him in the past. Why should we trust him in the future? Well, if we couldn't trust the vaccine manufacturers in the past, and we couldn't trust the CDC and the NIH to make sure it was done right, why should we ever trust them again?
Well, that's a very good point, Dr. Stan, and I don't think we should trust them again. They you mentioned lying several times. I'm on Neil Miller's website, and he's written several books on vaccines, and he has a section on immunization ploys. And you're exposing the New World Order on your program, and basically the way they operate is like an occult group. They conceal how vaccines are made. They conceal who they're tested on. They conceal the low efficacy rates. Their margin of profit is concealed. It's considered a trade secret. At the time that my son got his shot in 1978, the pertussis part of the DPT cost 3 or 4 cents to make. And I paid $80 for the DPT shot and the oral polio vaccine. and another $80 for the office visit. And I paid it, I paid in cash out of my pocket. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't part of it wasn't part of an insurance plan. And basically all I wanted to do was have my baby checked out after, you know, after he was born. And part of one of the ploys that Neil mentions in his book is the surprise attack. I had no idea I was going to be faced with the a decision of whether to vaccinate him or not. And I was told this is totally routine. Nobody mentioned the fact that of 8 infants that received pertussis vaccine, just the pertussis vaccine, 2 of them died. And I don't think 25% is a very good ratio. And the other thing that they consistently do is when they do a study, if someone dies in a vaccine study, they're just dropped from the study. You know, they don't even do an autopsy and try to find out if the vaccine had anything to do with it. They just make a note that the subject was dropped, and usually vaccines are tested on disenfranchised groups. You know, nobody in their right mind would volunteer their children for a vaccine study. So these are groups of, babies born to mothers in prison, or other disenfranchised groups, or at any rate groups that aren't told the real, they're not told about what they're actually doing in the test.
And then, of course, they don't follow them. They follow them for only a very short period of time, and if they don't die immediately, why they ignore them. And even if they do have serious problems and deaths, they ignore that as well. That's what they did with the rotavirus vaccine. And this was for an intestinal diarrhea. And so they gave this to children, a trial, and one child died, and a number of them got, 4 or 5 of them got intussusception. It's sort of like a herniation, internal herniation of the bowel. They totally ignored that. And they rushed that through onto the market, and they gave millions of doses of that. And then more and more children started getting intussusception, and a number of them died, and eventually they had to take it off the market. But, you know, why didn't they give it a long-term trial to find out? These children aren't dying of intussusception. Of rotavirus. The only time a child dies of rotavirus is they don't get in the hospital and get adequate hydration. I mean, this is not a lethal condition. Very, very few children in the United States had died of this, and yet they gave it to millions of American children and finally had to take it off the market because it wasn't safe. But was anybody ever tried and for this misuse of a medicine? Any government official ever fired? No.
No, it's just, oops, I'm sorry.
Well, they're not even sorry. They're sorry that they got caught at it, because usually what happens is you work for the FDA, and then, of course, when you get ready to retire there, you go to work for one of the vaccine manufacturers, maybe as a vice chairman or something, and you get a nice severance pay from them when you quit. And you hate to say that this goes on, but this is how it really works in the real world. They call it the medical governmental complex or the medical industry.
Medical pharmaceutical.
Right, medical pharmaceutical, that's right.
Yeah.
People don't like to say this, but the doctors are being manipulated in this. They're not being told of the complications from so many of the vaccines. And then, of course, they're told, look, the parents are just ignoring this. Now, the doctor is supposed to report adverse reactions, but a lot of times they're almost afraid to. And, of course, then the doctor feels, well, he may end up getting sued, and so he's not going to make an issue. He's going to do everything he can to assure the patient that they're just imagining it. Just because the child was completely normal until they got the vaccine, and they suddenly began to, and this happens many times at 2, 3, or 4, these kids are walking, talking, and suddenly they just begin to regress to a child, you know, to an infantile status. And, well, it's just coincidence. It just happened, but it's only coincidence. Have you heard that story?
Yeah, they say there's no causality. It's just a temporal relationship. And they even put out even after DPT, which is now the National Vaccine Information Center, Barbara Lowe Fisher's group, even after they got the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, the government still published a brochure that said it's just a coincidence that these severe reactions happen around the time of your DPT shot, or that SIDS occurs around the time of your DPT
shot. Now, that's sudden infant death shot is a syndrome where these children get a shot and a couple of days later they die.
Yeah, and actually there's three really good studies that independently corroborate each other. One is the TORCH study that shows that of infants who SIDS cases, 25% of SIDS cases occurred 1 week after a DPT shot. 2 weeks after a DPT shot, there was a 50% correlation, and 3 weeks afterwards, there was a 70% correlation. And there appears to be a delayed hypersensitivity with the pertussis in particular. And that was the TORCH study done at University of Nevada at Las Vegas.
Well, we know they were lying, because if they weren't lying and they knew they were lying, why did they change the pertussis vaccine eventually? But, you know, only, of course, when Barbara Lowe Fisher and other mothers finally got so much pressure on them. So they lied and they lied and they lied, and this is what's so infuriating about this. And nothing is ever done. And of course, they have immunity from persecution to prosecution.
Yes, they do. They're like... they're like priests in the Middle Ages. They were immune to the basic laws of European society in the Middle Ages. My group is down here in San Diego County, and we're working right now with a lady who's being accused of shaken baby syndrome.
Now, why don't you get into that? Because they're sending innocent people to prison. Rather than admit that they get the vaccines, the child becomes comatose, they autopsy them, and they find all the hemorrhages in the brain. And they're not from shaking the baby. The hemorrhages are a result of the vaccines. But it's easier to send the person to prison than to admit the truth. Would that be a fair statement?
I have to agree with you, because that's what's happening. And... In a few years ago, when I looked at the statistics, there were over 1,200 shaken baby cases in the country, an epidemic basically since 1991 or 92. And the whole shaken baby syndrome is based on a study of 4 or 5 children. And it was done, you know, years after the fact. And they just, you know, they never examined these children or questioned the mother or anything. They just did a retroactive study of medical records.
And of course, I think the thing is, anybody who gets vaccines now has to realize that they may end up being sent to prison for life if there is a reaction to those vaccines, and they're accused of being responsible for their child's problem. And of course, they will not, they'll make it very, very difficult for you to try to bring out the truth that they just had gotten the vaccines a couple of days before.
Yeah, this lady that I'm working with now is she's an American citizen, but she's a Filipino expatriate, and she's serving her country. She's aboard the U.S. Nimitz now, and this was her second child. And she was in the Navy, of course, already receiving many vaccines herself, including the anthrax vaccine. And she developed gestational diabetes. Now, it was contraindicated to give her daughter a hepatitis B shot after, you know, within 24 hours of her birth, because of the gestational diabetes. And also, she's in her 30s, so...
I'm going to have to interrupt you there. We want to get to this story as soon as we get back here.
Okay, Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Sue Sherman. We're talking about this woman who, of course, is Filipino in the military, gestational diabetes. Her child gets a hepatitis B shot in the nursery. Was it in the nursery or how soon after birth?
It was on the third day after birth.
All right. They're still in the nursery then.
Yeah, she was still in the hospital. And so... 2 months later, she's in the same hospital, Naval Hospital here in San Diego, and her daughter's having seizures, and actually had two subdural hematomas with retinal hemorrhaging, which is which are indications of how the medical textbooks define shaken baby. They don't mention subdural hematoma in connection with the hepatitis B reaction at all in the medical textbooks. But in order to have shaken baby syndrome, you have to have diffuse axonal injury, which is a shearing of the neck muscles or some abnormality in the tissues surrounding the cervical vertebrae. And this child's... was examined, was her radiology records from the day that she was admitted to the hospital with these seizures show that her neck muscles were grossly normal. In other words, they were totally intact. So even by the definition of shaken baby syndrome, which I think is a fictitious disease, this baby did not have shaken baby syndrome. But her children, the children were... An older son was taken by Child Protective Services, and although the mother was allowed to stay with her daughter in the hospital, as soon as the hospital stay was up, another 12 days, the baby went with a foster home. So, you know, she spent, it's coming up on a year now to the baby's, in fact, I think today is the anniversary of the day the baby was given the hepatitis B injection, and we still haven't got the matter resolved.
Well, now, did they take off the subdural hematomas? How did they? What did they do with them? Did they actually decompress them?
Yeah, she actually had to have surgery, and one of the subdurals was. Approximately 2 weeks old, so it happened at 6 weeks of age, and the other one was more recent. So she's, you know, she's doing well, but she has seizures. She has to be treated for seizures, and you know, she's got. It remains to be seen what kind of permanent damage she's going to have.
But now, is there any evidence or any history at all? I've never heard that a hepatitis B vaccine shot could create subdural hematomas.
Yes. In fact, there's plenty of there's a attorney here in San Diego, Tony Blake, and she's got a website of her own. She's collected lots of data on it. She started out on the Manjeet Basuda case, which was a caregiver accused of shaken baby syndrome with an infant who eventually died. But yeah, the hepatitis B vaccine causes this subdural. It also, you know, the retinal hemorrhaging could have been caused from either the vaccine or it could have been something at birth. But there's usually an underlying problem, like the gestational diabetes or a premature infant is when these are usually happening. But the different additives in the vaccine and the vaccine itself are causing subdural hematomas. And the frightening thing is that when, you know, when these doctors testify, you know, there's a whole set of doctors that testify that this is shaken baby, and then there's a whole other set of doctors, including Harold Buttram, is one of the MDs that we have, who testifies that this is consistent with a hepatitis B vaccine reaction. And so there's a lot of these attorneys that work with shaken baby syndrome. They're able to use this vaccine defense quite well. And in fact, almost everybody that's been accused of shaken baby syndrome, if they're not getting off in the initial criminal trial, they're getting off on appeal.
Well, now, of course, the thing is, I don't think any child, unless mother has hepatitis B, should have hepatitis B vaccine. It's
exactly.
Absurd. It's the stupidest thing in the world. I think it's a criminal negligence on the part of our CDC that said, well, and the rationale was this. Oh, you know, homosexuals and promiscuous people and IV drug users, and that's the group that gets hepatitis B, are not responsible people, and they won't come in and get their vaccines, so we want to give it to everybody in the emergency room, pardon me, in the nursery, so that they'll be immune. The trouble is, the immunity wears off by the time they're 10 or 12.
Exactly.
And, of course, then they've got to give it to them again.
And they've got to get it again in junior, 7th grade or so.
And they don't know whether this is going to work or not. This is a massive experiment on the, and the human suffering that's come from this is just unimaginable. And people, some people have gone to prison. There's a gentleman I've talked to in the East. He's been in prison 6 or 7 years, something like that, for shaken baby syndrome. And there's no question at all in my mind, having gone over the records and talked to his wife and talked to him, that this was all vaccine related. But you see, the vaccine companies can't allow this information to get out because the one thing they fear is the American people are going to lose confidence in vaccines, you know, especially if they ever find out that we contaminated 90 million people with the cancer virus and the original polio vaccine, and then probably hundreds of millions with other monkey viruses, so-called stealth viruses, with the updated polio vaccine. So they've lied to the people about this, and the average person has never heard these stories.
Yes. Yeah, I certainly have, Dr. Stan. I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, the most famous shaken baby case was the nanny case, the au pair in Massachusetts.
Well, tell us about that. Have you followed that one?
Yes, I did. And everybody in this country had to listen to, you know, different opinions about that case for months. That went on for months. It was in the news every day.
But was that, did they ever really bring up the fact of the vaccination aspect of it?
It was brought up in the trial. Barry Scheck used the vaccine defense.
See, we never heard that. I mean,
no,
I didn't hear that.
Nobody.
Totally blacked out by the controlled media.
Yes, absolutely. And just because just the idea of that would have made people think twice about, you know, about the next time they went to their pediatrician.
Now, was Barry Scheck the defense attorney?
Yes, he worked on the case. He worked on Louise Woodward's case.
Well, okay, but now was he actually the attorney, or is he?
I don't think he was the main attorney, but he maybe he was, but he was one of the junior attorneys on the OJ trial.
That's where I heard of him initially.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that's amazing. I had never heard that was brought up in that case. So obviously, somebody controlled what the American people heard about it.
Right, and they were willing to put this 19-year-old girl through all this trouble just because, you know, they were trying to throw it was a distraction. They were trying to throw the attention onto somebody else. And, I mean, that was an expensive trial, and this woman wasn't even exonerated, and it was just a witch hunt. And, of course, the judge, you know, could see through, you know, he determined that the evidence presented couldn't convict her, so he let her off for time served. but they didn't pronounce her innocent. And she's studying law now. And she's working for, this is what a responsible person that they demonized, she's working for the attorneys who worked on her case.
Good for her.
Well,
she's back in the United States. I thought that she was deported to England.
She wasn't deported. She just left as soon as she could.
Okay. And now, did she go to law school or what?
She's in law school and she's a law clerk. She's paying off the attorneys that who helped represent her.
Well, good for her.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's so many human tragedies out there that are related to vaccines. And, you know, the incidence of autism used to be about 1 in 10,000, and now it's 1 in 250 here, in California. Mm-hmm. Is that a fairly accurate figure?
Yeah, it's actually 1 in 150.
150 now. It's even rising higher then.
Yeah, of recent recent reports, in other words, of children in that age bracket that report to, you know, their school. And in Granite Bay, California, which is a suburb of Sacramento, it's 1 in 135, and that's where Rick Rollins is. He's a father of an autistic child, and he's very active in California autism.
Well, now, because some of these children actually can improve. What about, are any of them getting detoxified to get the mercury out of their system?
Yes, there's different protocols that are working, and the way they're approaching it is as an immune system disease or a...
autoimmune disease, right.
Yeah, and one of the first reversals of autism that I heard about was Cynthia Goldenberg, and she was given an award by NVIC, but she's a parent who, when her son was about 4, she had good insurance, and she talked her MD into infusions of immune factors, blood immune factors, and that, along with, you know, a few changes in his diet, he was able to reverse. At age 11, his autism was fully reversed, and he was an A student, and just a real bright boy.
Now, tell me about this blood immune factors. I'm not acquainted with that.
Well, you're familiar with Dr. Andrew Wakefield.
Yeah, surely.
Okay, his study found that these vaccine viruses end up in the small intestine and the gut of these kids who are autistic. They've also got, you know, gastrointestinal problems like colitis and Crohn's disease.
Now, these are actually children who've had MMR primarily.
Yeah, about half of them were MMR. But the DPT and some of the other vaccines were also implicated.
Okay, fine.
And so it may be the thimerosal again, because thimerosal affects every membrane in your body. And biologically, that's what we are, is we're different membranes. That's how we differentiate the different structures in our body. So what thimerosal is doing, apparently, is causing leaky gut, and it breaks down the blood-brain barrier. So you've got leaky brain and leaky gut. So large protein molecules are going that shouldn't go into the bloodstream are going into the blood from this leaky gut, and they're affecting, and then they're able to go right into the brain and cause these bizarre behaviors that are associated with autism or PDD. And so what they're doing is they're trying to, by diet, they're eliminating some of those larger molecules that might be implicated, and they're beefing up the child's immune system with effusions of, blood immune factors like IgE and I'm not sure exactly what Garrett Goldenberg, what kind of infusions he got, but he did these infusions for several years, and it helped him. It helped his immune system actually probably get rid of some of these vaccine viruses that were still hanging out there, causing his the structures of his small intestines to change. So
I know some people have actually used the various things to detoxify, get the mercury out of the body. Have you heard about that at all?
Yeah, there's chelation and various things like that. My son is starting on, although he's 25 now, we're starting on a chelation program with him.
The whole idea is to get the mercury out of the brain, because, of course, the mercury has affinity getting into the brain. And, of course, at least it's been said, and I don't know whether it'll help your son at his age, but that some of the children, once they get the mercury out, why their brain function has the capacity to actually improve.
Yes, and you can see why thimerosal is so toxic, and it has an affinity for brain tissue. Organic mercury binds, real well with brain tissue and other organs of the body.
Now, I think what's so really interesting is that in the Office of Homeland Security legislation, in the thousands, and I don't know how many pages that was, but, it was something that was so big nobody bothered to read it. Somebody just happened to put in there a special provision that the people who manufactured thimerosal couldn't be sued. What company was that, do you recall?
That's Eli Lilly.
And, of course, the justification was, we had to do that because, after all, if we didn't do that, why Eli Lilly wouldn't make any more vaccines. And we've got to, what would happen to America if we didn't have these vaccines? But what they did, if it told anybody, is Eli Lilly doesn't make vaccines. It hasn't made vaccines in, a decade or more.
Right.
All they make is the thimerosal, and they knew it was toxic, and they sold it to the vaccine manufacturers. And, of course, when they say, we've got to protect Eli Lilly or they won't make any more vaccines, that was a gross lie. But then most of what goes on today, especially with the current administration, is not telling the truth.
Yeah, that addition to the Homeland Security bill that just appeared overnight came right from the White House. And so I would say that George Bush is the best friend Eli Lilly ever had.
Well, Krista, I don't know whether it's really George Bush, but certainly the people who surround him, the Dick Cheneys and the Donald Rumsfeld and the Paul Wolfowitz and all these other people, the people who surround him, I wouldn't trust, with my daughter.
I wouldn't either. I think the point in any of this, after being an activist for the last 15 years, I'm not going to write any more congressmen or write any more letters because they successfully ignored more important people than myself, and they've ignored the facts. So I don't think they're going to change their intent on there's an occult purpose to this that we don't. We keep trying to make sense out of this thing, but it can't be done because there's a purpose that they're not telling us about.
Now, what are you thinking might be that purpose?
Well, money is an obvious. Money is obviously the one of the purposes, but it seems to be such a huge amount of money that. That they're trying to accumulate, there must be a larger purpose than that. And
I think you're absolutely right. But of course, you see the certain things that people find difficult to believe. It's sort of like Richard Mayberry, who wrote a couple of books. He writes the early warning newsletter. It's a financial newsletter. After studying the First and Second World Wars, in great detail and writing books on both of them, his conclusion was, there is a thing out there that wants to see death and destruction. There was no reason for these wars. They were prolonged. There is a thing that wants to see human suffering. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that there are people who have no concern at all about human life. In fact, they enjoy seeing human suffering. And that's very difficult for people to believe, unless
yes.
we think about the concentration camps in Germany, unless we think about the 60,000 people who are murdered, and of course in Russia, the 60 to 80,000 that were made, the 60 million in Russia, and 60 to 80 million in China. And then of course maybe we begin wondering, well, maybe there really are people out there, and especially because of course all of this was covered up by people here in America, so the American people would never know. So I share your concern, Sue. And so are we making any progress? Are people beginning to understand? Are parents beginning to question? Certainly we know that, you know, with this new smallpox vaccine, and they've been telling us how important it is, and they've offered it to, they want to inoculate 10 to 12 million healthcare workers. So far, I think they got about 2,500 or maybe 250 to come forward and be immunized, and the rest of them are just not going to do it. They're saying, we're not going to do it.
That's great. I think that's great. And our California Nurses Association has come out against the smallpox vaccine. And perhaps because the nurses have been left out in the cold more than once, there's a whole group of nurses that have neurological damage from rubella vaccine and chronic fatigue syndrome. There's a whole other group of Hep B injured nurses. And
Tell me about the Hep B injured nurses.
Well, there's a group here in California led by Sherry Nakin, and she was a nurse, and you know, you have to
everybody had to take the hepatitis B, right?
Yeah, everybody that works in a hospital except for the doctors has because they're not employees, has to get a hepatitis B shot.
What happened to these nurses?
Well, they've got neurological complications. One of them that I met at an NVIC conference had a foot drop. She has one leg that doesn't work. So she has hemiparalysis, and you know, they've got vague autoimmune type disorders like fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue, things like that. And there's a study done by Al Allen of University of California, Riverside, and he showed that these nurses that had chronic fatigue, that their chronic fatigue symptoms, you know, they wax and wane. You know, sometimes they're feeling good, and then other days they can't even get out of bed. Well, on those days that they couldn't get out of bed, they had rubella antibodies, high titers of rubella antibodies, and they'd never had rubella, but they had been, they'd had several rubella shots. So he had every single person in that study had 100% correlation. When they were having symptoms, they had high titers of rubella antibodies.
And it would actually fluctuate then, huh?
Yes. And so here's a perfect study, 100% correlation, straight line correlation. But he couldn't get anybody interested in this study that he did. It's published in Medical Hypotheses. But he was also working on an AIDS vaccine or an AIDS drug. And he had every company knocking on his door wanting to market this, and he's saying, I don't even know if this works yet. And it didn't matter. They've got an AIDS drug. It doesn't matter if it works. Just give us the rights to it and let us take it away from here. And he wouldn't let him do it. He had enough integrity that he wouldn't let them do it. But his other study, which is so pristine, nobody's interested because that would take a product off the market. And nobody wants to hear about it.
Well, I think that more and more people are getting the message today. I think that I'm constantly getting calls from parents who are something saying, we're not going to vaccinate our children. What do you think about the vaccines? And I say, well, you have to make that decision, but I try to give them the pros and cons. Have you written anything at all? Do you have a website, anything like that, Sue, you'd like to get out?
Yeah, I've written several things, but I'm on Neil Miller's website.
All right, and what's that one?
That's thinktwice.com.
Thinktwice.com, and what does that cover?
That covers, he's written several books. Neil Miller has written several books, and that's a basically a vaccine information website. And he's just a parent. He's a father who investigated, did all the research before his children were even born. And the name of my organization is Citizens Awareness Network Against Doctor-Induced Diseases, CANDID. And my telephone number and address are on there.
All right, fine. And
under support groups.
All right, fine. You can give your telephone number out if you want to. It's all right for me.
Yeah, sure. It's 619-443-3030.
And, of course, the great tragedy is we're seeing more and more disease. And they're saying, think of all the people that die if we didn't have the vaccines. And what they don't tell you is that the incidence of all these diseases had dropped dramatically before the vaccines came out. In fact, by the time of the measles vaccine became available, there were only 44 children in the entire country died that year of measles.
Yeah. Well, you know what Dr. Mendelsohn said, Robert Mendelsohn, you know, you're going to trade measles and mumps for cancer and leukemia.
Now, what is the relationship between the vaccines and cancer? Because I've heard it said that, you know, we did not see anywhere near the incidence of cancer before we started all the vaccines that we've seen since then. What's the truth about that?
Well, there's a statistically significant relationship, because since mandatory vaccination has increased, so have cancer and leukemia. And Robert Mendelsohn wasn't the only one. There was a whole study done at Rutgers University in the early 60s before they started pushing a lot of these vaccines. And apparently part of the problem is contaminating monkey viruses, like you mentioned earlier, with simian virus 40.
And, of course, the only reason it happened was because instead of thoroughly evaluating it and using it for a long period of time, they rushed into production because they wanted to get all the money. And, of course, they were never held responsible because nobody's ever been told that they've contaminated, 93 million Americans with this monkey cancer virus. And now people are coming down with these cancers, and they're saying, well, that's just coincidence, just because they had the same virus and this tumor that we know it'll produce the tumors in animals, but just because it produces in human beings, that doesn't mean anything. And you wonder how dumb people can really be. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Sue, you have
the telephone
number?
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
You have the telephone number to call in the morning for us?
Yes, I do.
All right, fine. So we'll be talking to you bright and early, and Sue's going to be on our early morning program at 7 o'clock. And if you listen to our American Freedom Network program, why, you'll certainly want to hear her, and we'll cover some of these same items again. Well, anyway, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
No, I just appreciate what you do so much, because I think the vaccine industry is kind of an entry point for the New World Order. It's part of their program, and so I think it's real important to look at it.
God bless you. Good night, sir.
God bless you.
And, of course, we ask you to pray for our boys going into battle, probably tomorrow or the next day. Pray for our civilians over there. Pray for our leaders. Pray for, certainly, revival in America. And lastly, please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Well, at least you know a lot of parents out there have advice about all this. All we can do is get the information out. You sit there. More and more being. And I think the fact that the nurses aren't taking those shots is a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, if the smallpox actually occurs, it'll be a whole different situation. If it occurs,